Hi, this is episode 52 of K. Ray Reads to You. Today we have chapter 2 of The Apple Stone by Nicholas Stewart Gray. Chapter 2. Bird of Paradise. Before we went in for tea, we agreed to rush up to the attic as soon as we'd gulped it down, in order to start experimenting. There was some argument over what to start with. Missy was still on about her teddy bear, and the clans had some idea about an old rocking horse. I insisted that we ought to begin with something small. They said I was craven. Joe said, what about the Dresden shepherdess? We overruled the suggestion on the grounds that she, the shepherdess, had a frightful simper, and would obviously be a dead boar. Joe said she couldn't be worse than a horse in the attic, with or without its rockers. The attics are our playrooms. There are several of them across the top of the house, of mixed shapes and sizes, with low-beamed ceilings and dormer windows in two of them. They are our private property, as long as we play fair, like not setting fire to them, or anything of that sort. It keeps us out of our parents' way while they're being inspired. I mean the parents of Joe and Missy and myself. I regret to say they are Auntie Monica and Uncle Dudley, who work some horrible little glove puppets called Ben and Bet Bun for television. They write the scripts, our parents, not the dolls, and handle the tiresome pop-eyed rabbit things. The series is, of course, strictly for the tots, but our parents call it art, and they mean this with a capital A. Once I heard my mother actually say it was poetry in pattern, and she wasn't laughing. There always seems something odd about people who get embroiled with puppets. They are never quite human anymore. We are fond of our mum and dad, and hope they may grow out of it in time. To return to our attics, they've been furnished with all the odds and ends thrown out from the rest of the house over the years. Mrs. Chug, a lady who comes every day to cook and clean up, is allowed in the attics once a week, and she mustn't disturb anything we've left about, like Nigel's drawing, or Joe's photographs of animals, or my books and half-finished stories. We've all promised not to leave anything lying about, unless we're really in the middle of doing something with it. At tea time this particular evening, Mrs. Chug was in one of her stern moods. She gets them from time to time, when she decides we're all neglected and need discipline. Both of the clans were forced to change their clothes completely, owing to their goings-on in the ditch, and Nigel had to change his socks twice, though it was his own fault for only changing one the first time. Douglas had to wash four times before Mrs. Chug passed him as clean. My grazed ankle was smothered in iodine with little outward sympathy. And poor old Ragnar was banished to the scullery in disgrace when he suddenly laid his head sideways along the table and ate a plateful of kipper bones in one gulp. "Shouldn't be here in the first place," snapped Mrs. Chug when Joe pleaded for him. "'Tisn't right to have dogs about at mealtimes, if you can properly name that beast a dog." "What would you name him?" I said. "He more like an elephant." "Where's his trunk?" said Douglas. Mrs. Chug said she didn't want any sauce from him. "Born and bred in the wilds as you were," said she, "all among them eagles and stags at bay, you'll have to try and behave civilized among civilized folk." "Douglas does live in Scotland, near Fort William, but it's not all that savage, though Ben Nevis does tend to loom a bit, and once I saw an eagle there, deer too." Douglas was annoyed with Mrs. Chug. He said, "If you call Devon civilized, with all those dunes and things, and smugglers and wreckers—" "Not now," said Mrs. Chug. "I bet there are," rapped Douglas. "I bet you're a secret smuggler yourself. I bet you creep out on the cliff with a lantern and lure ships to their doom." Mrs. Chug said he had a wicked mind. Nigel asked if she'd take them wrecking with her one night, and she snapped that he was as bad as Douglas. "And from the same outlandish place," said she. Actually, Nigel lives in a rather grand house a few miles south of Oban. His mother had married Sir John Campbell, who invented electrical gadgets, and Douglas's mother had married Mr. Neil MacDonald, his assistant, and ours had married Mr. William Westray, an Englishman of Devon. All our mothers were sisters and Scottish, and once named Ramsay. So the clans were our cousins and each other's, and both their fathers had gone to America to fit some gadget of theirs on a rocket, and had taken their mothers with them, I mean the clans' mothers. So Douglas and Nigel had to stay with us for a year and go to my school. They were both homesick, and it was mean of Mrs. Chugg to rub it in. "Three of you is bad enough," she was now saying, "but five is beyond anything, and months to go before you'm back where you belong. I wish you were going tomorrow." "So do I," snarled Douglas. "I wish I'd never come. I wish the rotten rocket would explode now, so that Dad would come and get me out of here." Nigel had gone crimson and was stuttering like a machine-gun. "I wish the whole of Devon would explode. I wish you would explode." "You naughty heathen," said Mrs. Chugg. But she sounded milder, as if she knew she'd been too harsh. I said, "What about the attics now?" Nigel said he wished the attics would explode. "No, you don't. You're just cross," said Joe. "It would be very insulting to your hosts if you wished to destroy their home." "It wouldn't bother a Campbell," said Douglas, rapidly changing sides. I saw what was coming. The clans were now fighting mad, and they didn't care who they attacked. At any moment one of them would speak the forbidden word, and we'd get no more sense from either of them the whole evening. Nigel's eyes were almost sparking with rage, and Douglas was laughing in a high, wild sort of way. "If you say it," I told him sternly, "you'll never play with the Applestone." I saw the word die on his tongue, and Mrs. Chugg gave us all a harassed look. She said, "Yes, you run along to your old attics. You're all a bunch of savages, and that's about the truth of it." "Savages are nice," said Missy, who knew nothing about them. "Yes, yes," said Mrs. Chugg. She opened the pantry door and took out a full package of mixed cookies. "Here," she went on, "take these with you and share them around." "Keep your rotten old," began Douglas. "Poisoned cookies," said Nigel. "Thank you very much, Mrs. Chugg," I said quickly, taking the package. "That's very kind of you. Thank you." "All right, my dear, don't eat too many," said she. "Now take yourselves off, do." We took ourselves off. As we went along the hall to the back stairs, I could hear a lot of whispering and giggling behind me from Missy and the clans. I was glad our cousins had simmered down, but no foreboding came to me. The back stairs were narrow and twisty, and we liked them better than the grander affair in the front hall. I noticed vaguely that Mrs. Chugg's hat and coat were on the wooden chest at the foot of the stairs. Her best hat and coat, which meant she wasn't just going straight home. She always went to the local cinema on a Friday evening. I wondered why she had such a staggering taste in hats. She was a large person, and usually dressed in blue or gray, and quite plainly. When not being stern, which was mostly, she looked like a plump wood pigeon. But her hats were rowdy, and this was the worst of them all. It was covered with green net, and flowers, and a gaudy bird sitting on top. As I rounded the first bend of the stairs, the bird flew past me with a piercing shriek and vanished into the dark hall above. I stopped dead. I looked back at my relatives. Joe, just below me, had turned also to look at them. "Jemima!" she exclaimed. "You wicked little girl!" "Serves her right for being horrible," said Missy. "It was my idea," said Douglas defiantly. "You must be mad," I told him. "What a terrible thing to do," said Joe. "It was a terrible thing to have on a hat," said he. "It was asking for it," said Nigel. "That's not the point," I snapped. Joe said they must put it back immediately, before Mrs. Chugg got through with the dishes. I pointed out that we'd have to find it first. We all tore upstairs, and I switched on the light, but there was no sign of the hat bird. We could see the whole corridor, with its two rising steps halfway along, the pictures on the walls, the little dower chest, the balustrades, and the top of the front staircase, the wider hall beyond, the tall oak cupboard there. "It's gone on up to the attics," said Joe. Douglas had rushed up there, and now he came halfway down the narrow stairs and said the door at the top was shut. "It must be somewhere," I said. "Maybe it went through a window," suggested Nigel. "They're shut too," I said. Joe opened a tiny window at the near end of the passage and craned her neck to look out. There was a shrill scream behind us, and the bird came shooting from under the cupboard in a swirl of green and purple feathers and whizzed past Joe's head into the night. "Crafty, too," said Douglas admiringly. There was a pause. Joe and I looked at Missy severely. She looked back, with her mouth clamped into a straight line and two large tears rolling down her cheeks. She didn't blink or sob, but she cries so seldom that Joe instantly softened. "Oh, it wasn't your fault, love," she said. "It was entirely her fault," I said. "We trusted her with the Applestone, and she went fooling about behind our backs." "Not behind mine," said Douglas. "I held the hat." "And I helped," supported Nigel. "Behind the backs of everyone sensible," I snapped. Missy took the locket chain from her neck and loosened the mouth of a little red silk bag she'd hung on it and let the apple stone roll out into her hand. She gulped and then said in a small voice, "Please, what shall we do next?" The stone mumbled something. "What?" said Missy. Then she remembered her manners and asked it to repeat what it had said. "Don't bother me," said the apple stone. "You really must learn to manage on your own." Missy stroked it cautiously with one finger. "Oh, please," she repeated, "do help. We'll get into such trouble, and it was my fault. I was meant to look after you, and I shouldn't have let—" A tear plopped off her chin and fell on the stone, and it shook itself and made a noise like a yawn. "I scented trouble," it said moodily. "What have you done?" We told it, in turn and in chorus, and at the end it giggled. "A thunderstorm in an egg cup," it said. "If you'd seen some of the botchery—" "Mrs. Chug will be terribly upset," put in Joe. "Why be concerned?" it asked. "I heard a few snatches of her conversation, and it serves her right to lose her pet. It will be happier away from such a bully." "No, no," I said. "She didn't mean any of it, not really." "And it's not exactly a pet," added Joe. "More of an ornament," said Nigel. "A load of glue and feathers," said Douglas. "Mrs. Chug likes it," said Missy sadly, "and usually we like her. We ought not to upset her." "Then why are you waiting? Why ask me what to do?" said the stone. "You know how to restore the thing to its nature. I told you clearly." Then we remembered. "Of course, we're mad," cried Joe. "Shut our eyes for 2 minutes and not speak and not think about you." We all sat down on the stairs and shut our eyes. While we were doing this, two words came floating into the back of my brain, in the way things do float so often, for me anyway. Horse's tail. They drifted about a bit and faded again. I wondered how we'd know when the 2 minutes were over. I couldn't look at my watch, in case it was too soon and spoiled everything. I concentrated on not thinking about the apple stone. I heard Missy give a hopeless sigh. There was a grunt from Douglas, and then Nigel coughed restlessly. Joe moaned, and the two words suddenly came back to me, and this time they made sense. I said, "All right, everyone, you can open your eyes. It's impossible. Piebald horses' tails." They stared at me. Then Joe's face fell, and she said slowly, "Oh, yes, of course." The clans looked staggered, and even Missy got the point. We had all been told, when we were young, that anyone could have a wish who saw a piebald horse and didn't think of its tail. We'd proved again and again that it was a hopeless condition. You could see a piebald horse a dozen times without a thought of its tail, until you remembered about the wish, and not thinking of its tail, and so you'd thought of its silly tail, and that was that. "I only thought of the apple stone," said Joe. The rest of us nodded in gloomy agreement, and Missy lifted the stone on her hand and said in deep reproach that it must have known what would happen. "Not knew. Guessed, perhaps. Yet you might have done it. Nobody else has in 100 million years," it said. "But you might have been the first." "Well, we aren't," I said. "We'll never break the magic by that method." "There is no other," said the stone. Silence fell. "Then the bird is gone," said Joe, in a voice of doom, "and Mrs. Chug will come looking for us. She'll guess we did something with it." "She won't guess what," said Douglas. Missy and Nigel giggled, and Joe turned on them in the rage that comes over anyone about to be caught red-handed in a crime they didn't commit and can't explain. Joe likes things to be fair, and they so seldom are. "Since you've been so clever," she said through her teeth, "you'd better invent what we're going to tell her. She'll want her bird, you know, and we're going to look a bit silly saying we don't know where it is." The apple stone gave a small cough. It said, "If I might offer a suggestion..." We all begged it to do so. "I know I shouldn't," it said. "I should let you face the consequences of your folly." Douglas threw back his head and shouted angrily that it was nothing to do with anyone but himself. "I thought of it, to annoy old Chuggy, so don't go blaming the others." "I backed you up," put in Nigel. "And I actually did it," said Missy. "Apart from actual blame, I am speaking of carelessness," said the stone, "and that applies to all of you. Can you not assimilate the fact that you are in possession of very dangerous power? This time you have loosed a harmless bit of magic, but another time you may find yourself in desperate straits if you act so rashly." "Look, please, Applestone," said Joe, "you did say you had a suggestion." "Can any of you draw?" it said. The question took us by surprise. It was a moment or two before Missy said, "Nigel can. He won a prize." Nigel scowled at her. "He gets very touchy about it, but in fact he's rather good. What our art master at school calls highly promising. Sometimes he'll let you see what he's painting or drawing, and sometimes he carries on like a maniac if you merely look over his shoulder. Joe says this is temperament and a sign of genius. I think it's temper and a sign of bad manners. All the same, he did win a prize." "Then Nigel must draw a hat bird," said the Applestone. We thought this over. Then our faces cleared, all but Nigel's. He said, suppose he refused. He said he couldn't just do things to order. "Of course you can," said Joe. "Of course you will," I said. "Come on, Rembrandt," said Douglas. Missy offered to go and get her crayons and slate. "Thanks for nothing," snarled Nigel. "I wouldn't use that messy rubbish. I've got my own stuff." He was so rattled that he forgot to stutter, and he dashed up to the attics with terrific speed. We followed. A space was cleared on the big old kitchen table under the light in the biggest of the attics. Nigel got his best drawing block and a lot of poster paints, and Joe filled a jam jar with clean water and set it by his elbow. Then we stood about him, breathing heavily, until he told us to stop. "How can we? We'd die," said Missy. He said he didn't care. "Anyway, stop leaning," he growled. We retired a bit. He scribbled for a while, in a sort of frenzy. Then he ripped the sheet from the block, crumpled it into a ball, and flung it at Douglas. Douglas flung it back, and it knocked over a bottle of black Indian ink that dripped off the table onto Missy's foot. Nigel sprang at Douglas's throat. They both rolled under a chair, shouting. Joe and I dragged them apart, while Missy bawled at them, and we told Nigel sternly to pull himself together and get back to work. After considerable nagging, he did so. 10 minutes later, the floor was covered with crumpled paper, and he was spattering bright colors over everything in reach. We retired a bit farther. and at last he gave a huge sigh and slouched back in his chair. In front of him lay a picture of the Hat Bird. At least, it bore a slight resemblance. There was a garish blaze of colors in streaks and whorls, an angry head cocked at a watchful angle, and a pair of mad and glittering eyes. I didn't remember the original looking so lively, not even in flight. "Oh, well," I said, "it'll just have to do." "What do you mean?" demanded Nigel furiously. "Have to do?" Missy touched the painting with the apple stone. The splashes of red and orange and purple went into a frenzy on the paper. Long feathers fluttered and lifted, and sent a couple of pots of paint crashing to the floor. Bright eyes blinked. With a high shriek, the bird leaped into the air and clung to the light fixture, flapping its wings. "Touch me and I'll bite!" it screeched. At this moment, the little cat door at the bottom of the attic door was pushed open from outside, and Joe's cat, Mrs. Blossom, came padding into the room. She stopped, with one foot lifted delicately, and her eyes became round as she saw the bird. The bird saw her, too, and it gave an ear-piercing yell and flew straight out of the window. It took quite a time to calm Nigel. We gave him all the chocolates Joe had left over from her birthday, 3, to be exact, which he ate, scowling. We said how clever he was, and how we relied on him to get us out of this emergency. I told him he was a credit to the Campbells. Douglas tittered. Missy offered to be Nigel's slave for life, and he said he wouldn't have her as a gift. But at last he consented to try again. Joe made sure that Mrs. Blossom had gone into the toy cupboard and up onto the shelf where she kept her kitten. I made sure all the windows were shut. A lot more paper got torn and crumpled, but finally Nigel managed to produce another drawing not unlike the first. He said it lacked inspiration, but I snatched it away before he could destroy it. And Missy touched it with the stone. I put it quickly back on the table. From the paper rose the bird. Very slowly. It yawned. "I was tired when I did it," said Nigel defensively. "Good job, too," I said. "We don't want to be knee-deep in mad birds." "Come to me, Chickie," said Joe, holding out her hands. It took a couple of listless steps toward her, and collapsed into them. She stroked it, while it muttered sleepily, with its eyes shut. Its tail feathers fluttered drearily as we went down the stairs. Mrs. Chug was moving about in the kitchen, and we heard her closing up the stove. This meant she was on the point of departure. We were just in time. Joe put the bird on top of the hat, and it clucked softly and put its head under its wing. "It shouldn't be doing that," I hissed. "Shh," said Joe. "Don't wake it. It'll just have to be like that. If only it keeps still, maybe she won't notice any difference." Mrs. Chug started when she found us all standing in the hall. "Now what are you up to?" she said. "Just come to see you safely off," said Douglas. "To wish you good night," I said hurriedly. "And hope you enjoy the film, whatever it is," added Nigel. We were all talking in a whispering sort of way, not to wake the bird, and she eyed us doubtfully. But she decided we were just being a bit weirder than usual, and said quite amiably, "All right, my dears, good night then, and thank you. Don't go raising a lot of din when I'm gone, because your parents are working on their scripts. And just try to get some of that war paint off Nigel. He looks a proper Red Indian." She put on her hat, glanced into the hall mirror, and turned away. She didn't see the bird lift its head, cast a bemused look around, and go back under its wing. I gulped nervously and helped Mrs. Chug with her coat. She took up her gloves and handbag from a chair, thanked me, and went to the door. She turned again. We were all watching her closely. A nervous look crossed her face. "Don't stare so," she said, opening the door. She patted her hair self-consciously, and then her hat. "Don't disturb it," said Joe. "It's lovely as it is." "What, my bird of paradise? Oh, it's a poor old thing. Had it for years, but I'm fond of it," said Mrs. Chug. "Now, don't go forgetting your proper bedtimes, will you?" "No, we won't. Good night," we whispered. "Good night," said she. "Good night," said the bird. Luckily, she assumed one of us had spoken, and she just nodded and went out. The door shut behind her. "Phew," said Douglas. "Lummy," said Missy. "We must go and catch those other birds," said Joe. "We can't just leave them flying about." This proved more difficult than it sounded, and it didn't even sound easy. We searched the moonlit garden. We searched the shrubbery and the grove. We went across the deep lane into the farm fields beyond. We saw neither of the missing birds, though once I heard wings go rustling overhead, leaves moving in a tree, and a sharp little voice high on a branch saying, "One step nearer and I'll bite!" A big owl shot out of the tree with a yell, and behind it the voice shrieked, "Told you so!" Nigel happened to be near me, and I asked why on earth he'd made the creature so cross. "I put a blob of white on its eyes," he said. "It gives things an evil look." I didn't say how. I said why. "I like cross birds," he told me. "I forgot to put the white on the second one." Then there was a flutter of long tail feathers, and the original hat bird went sailing over us in the moonlight. I heard Missy ordering it to come down at once, and Joe making cooing noises at it, but it just flew on into a tree, and its voice floated back, crying dismally, "Cold! Want my hat?" When we got to the tree, it swooped out and away. It was hopeless, and to make everything worse, Douglas went and got Ragnar, which was absolute madness. The Dane entered into the spirit of the hunt with such abandon that he managed to catch a pheasant. Being soft-mouthed, he didn't hurt it, but it bit me when I released it. Then Ragnar thought he'd track me. He did this, cornered me, and gave a great bay of triumph and knocked me flat on my face over the rubbish heap. Wanting an audience, he went and got Joe. He dragged her by her sleeve all over the asparagus bed and showed me to her. Hearing our lifted voices, Missy came running, and Ragnar gave her so hearty a welcome that she fell down too, and yelled with rage. We lectured our dog, while he sat with a silly smile, and the paper bird came over, flying rather low, and the Dane hurled himself into the air at its tail. He missed it by a yard, and fell into the cucumber frame. Luckily, no one got cut by the smashed glass, not even Ragnar, who deserved to. We lost count of time. Then Father came. He found us in the field by the far pond. He said it was 11 o'clock, and why were we wailing and yelling so? Missy said Ragnar was doing it. "I didn't know he had such a vocal range," said Dad, "and a marvelous power of mimicry. He sounded, well, not exactly human, but verging on it." He then escorted us indoors. As I got into bed, I knew I would not sleep for worrying, and I heard wings go swishing past my window, and a thin little voice saying it couldn't find its hat. At some point in the night, I dreamed I opened the window, and the bird flew into my hair and made itself a nest there, and I dreamed that Joe was shaking me. And she was. It was morning. "It's on my head, in a nest," I said blearily. "It's back on her hat," said Joe. "I just went down to look, and it's 7:30, and you'll be late for breakfast. Both the paper birds are on their paper in the attic. The cross one looks crosser than ever, and I'm going to ask Nigel to give me the sleepy one. I got fond of it." I must have been looking quite blank, for she sat on my bed with a thump and said, "Oh, Jeremy, we all went to sleep. None of us spoke for over 2 minutes, and all our eyes were shut, and nobody thought of the Applestone. I'm surprised. We should have been writhing in nightmares about it." "There must have been 2 minutes when we weren't." I thought it all over. "I wonder why the Applestone didn't tell us this would happen," I said at last. "We asked it," said my sister, "and it said it forgot. It said this was a special dispensation only allowed to people under 15. It isn't very flattering, she sighed. It means we're expected to do silly things. We haven't let loose dragons yet, I said. Ragnar had followed Joe into my room, and he now heaved himself upon the bed beside her. The springs twanged protestingly. He stared at us. He's had some bad dreams, I said. My sister hugged the Dane. Don't worry, she told him. We'll be so careful from now on that nothing will go wrong again, ever. He whimpered in a morose sort of way. And that's the end of chapter 2. See you next time.